Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
If I could have your attention just a minute, I'd like to welcome everyone to tonight's edition of the Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture Series, a tradition that's been going 30 years plus strong. And just out of curiosity, how many of you are here for your first Dallas Philosophers Forum Lecture? Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. How'd you hear about us? Meetup? Just cruising the internet?
The internet.
Okay. Great. Glad you found us. We are a rather unique institution. We don't have any paid staff. We're all volunteers, nonprofit, and we do this just as a forum to be open to hearing about different kinds of ideas and worldviews. So we give them a respectful audience for about 45 or 60 minutes, and then we have chance for about 30 minutes of Q&A. Which is intended to better understand. It's not to attack or to tear down the speaker's point of view, but to kind of probe and better understand and draw out what the speaker's saying, because unlike a lot of organizations, we don't really try to promote any one particular viewpoint or set of beliefs. We just kind of want to be exposed to it all and make our own decisions. So. You know, there is no orthodoxy or really not much in the kind of doxy at all in this group, which is why I like it. Keep coming back because we try to keep the topics real varied. We try to cover the waterfront of ethics, aesthetics, metaphysics, practical issues, political philosophy. Try to cover the whole waterfront. Business matters, although we are completely nonprofit, we do have certain expenses. So we take up a $5 contribution at the door, and if you didn't get a chance to make that on your way in, on your way out, see our treasurer, David Alcock, over here at the end of this table, and he'll take care of you. And if you decide you want to be a regular, for $35, you can get a 6-month subscription, which is just a hair above half price, and really a pretty good deal. And I want to especially promote our Philosopher's Jeopardy event, the second annual, which will be coming May 26th. We're hoping for a bigger crowd than will fit in this room, so we're having it out at Unity of Dallas, which is out on Forest Lane between Hillcrest and Preston, north side of Forest, in their Fellowship Hall, which will see easily a couple hundred people. So come out, bring all your friends. We're going to give cash awards to the participants for second and third place for the three colleges, and so if you'd like to be part of that, you can make a tax deductible contribution.
There's a little flyer about it, and in addition, David, we're going to have dorm prizes.
Okay, great. So if you're feeling lucky, you can come and see if you walk away with something nice. But on to the delights of tonight's evening. We're very privileged to have with us Dr. Robert Sloan Lee, Ph.D. Dr. Lee did his undergraduate work here locally at UNT and then went to Wayne State University in Michigan for his master's and Ph.D. work and has been back here in the Metroplex for the past 10 years or so. Currently, he lectures at Mountain View College here in Dallas County, and he'll be speaking to us tonight on the interesting subject of miracles, philosophy, and contemporary science. So let's give a warm welcome to Dr. Lee.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a copy of my presentation to pass around.
Great, I'll help with that.
That's great. And while that's going around, let me just say thank you to Ken and the others for inviting me to come and speak tonight. And I want to thank you for coming and being very generous with your time and to come and hear my presentation. Just a little bit of personal information. I'm married. My wife is a Mary Kay consultant, and we have a daughter who's 9, and she has decided she wants to become a paleontologist. And she's been saying this since she was 3 years old. I figured it would change over to princess or something at some point, but it hasn't. So I'm I enjoy science fiction and fantasy of all types, and recently, in the last couple of years, I've been exploring the revival of board games, and in particular European strategy board games, and my favorite game currently is a game called Lords of Waterdeep. All right, so does everybody have a copy of the paper? Is it still going around? Anybody need a copy? Show your hand. You can follow along with me if you like, or you could just listen, either way. And I'll try to be quick with this so that we can have some question and answers afterwards. And not to be contentious, but you don't have to ask questions just for better understanding. I, in fact, invite hostile questions designed to tear down and punch holes in what I say tonight. This is a way I can guard myself against things like confirmation bias, and I appreciate any opposition or resistance that you can provide. So let me begin. The 20th century and beyond has been especially hostile to the notion of the miraculous, at least in some circles. Can I get a glass of water? It is sometimes suggested that those who appeal to the miraculous as an explanation are intellectually out of touch or philosophically careless, thank you, or less than fully rational or just plain dumb. Moreover, many seem to think that the force of the case against the miraculous is somehow tied to the enterprise of science. Ernest Hobson writes that the decay of the belief in miracles which has taken place progressively in modern times is undoubtedly due in large part to the progress of natural science. Rudolf Bultmann approvingly opines on the incommensurability of science and miracles. He says, modern man acknowledges as reality only such phenomena or events as are comprehensible within the framework of the rational order of the universe. He does not acknowledge miracles because they do not fit into this lawful order. When a strange or marvelous accident occurs, he does not rest until he has found a rational cause. However, neither Hobson nor Bultmann provide a satisfactory explanation as to why the progress of natural science should erode belief in the possibility of the miraculous. While these writers do seem to have in mind the vague notion that there is some sort of difficulty in reconciling science with belief in the miraculous, one naturally wonders about the exact nature of this difficulty. It is one thing to make claims like these. It is quite another thing to provide some reasons for thinking them to be true, or even plausible, or even not wildly implausible.
I think you just have to turn it off.
It's a miracle.
Please do.
It's a miracle.
Thank you.
It's an objection.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Why exactly do miracles strain against the scientific worldview, and where precisely is the incompatibility between science and miracles? It is not easy to see what the difficulty is. Yet given the pervasiveness of this sort of sentiment, it is appropriate to ask how and to what extent the physical sciences actually legitimize current doubts about the miraculous, and to ask whether or not belief in the miraculous is, as Rudolf Carnap, the famous logical positivist, claims, out of step with the scientific thinking of our day. Whatever argument may be offered for these claims, the general idea seems to be something like this. Given some fact about the scientific method or some general features of science, rational or well-grounded belief in the occurrence of miracles is not possible, or perhaps miracles simply do not occur. Here, some fact about the nature of science or about the scientific method is taken to be a defeater for the belief that miracles occur. So what is it about science that serves as a defeater for the miracle enthusiast? Thank you. The argument from scientific practice. Guy Robinson presents a case against the miraculous that appeals to the nature of science. Unfortunately, the case Robinson makes against miracles is not clearly set out. Rather, the essay seems to be an intertwining knot of related but different arguments against the miraculous that appeal in various ways to the nature of science. So we need to expend some effort untangling these arguments before their merits can be assessed. Early in the essay, Robinson states the following, and I quote, "Before what is commonly called the scientific era, there was a competition and a conflict both between religious explanations and what can be called loosely scientific explanations. The religious explanation was taken as sufficient in itself and is excluding any other. Describing a phenomenon like thunder as the work of God or the anger of the gods removed it from the natural order and assigned it to the supernatural order." Later, Robinson reflects on what would happen if a scientist attempted to apply this sort of pre-scientific thinking to anomalous events. He says, "Notice what would happen to the scientist if he allowed himself to employ the concept of an irregularity in nature or of a miracle in relation to his work. He would be finished as a scientist. And this would not be simply because his scientific colleagues would ridicule him and ignore his work, which they would, but because he could no longer work as a scientist as soon as he allowed himself to invoke the concept of a miracle to explain some result that he had got." Robinson goes on to add that a miracle is, quote, "is and will remain from the point of view of science an empty and unusable concept. It can have no role within science, and it can be given no role by science." Taken together, these passages seem to express the outlines of an argument that we can call the argument from scientific practice. This argument may be stated as follows. Premise one, miracles are events such that their supernatural explanations lie beyond the scope of the natural sciences. Premise two, if miracles are events such that their supernatural explanations lie beyond the scope of the natural sciences, then a miracle is not a concept that can be employed in the natural sciences. Premise three, if a miracle is not a concept that can be employed in the natural sciences, then any scientist who invokes the concept of a miracle as an explanation is not really doing natural science and is not, in doing so, working as a scientist. Therefore, from these premises, we get the conclusion. Any scientist who invokes the concept of a miracle as an explanation is not really doing natural science and is not, in doing so, working as a scientist. And this conclusion follows from these three premises. This argument clearly entails its conclusion. In brief, since miracles lack natural explanations, miracles themselves cannot be employed as scientific explanations. Moreover, all of the premises of this argument seem to be extraordinarily plausible, or so I think. In other words, it seems that this argument gives us excellent reason to believe its conclusion. Namely, those who appeal to the miraculous are not participating in the scientific enterprise. So far, so good. Unfortunately, the conclusion does not even come close to showing that miracles do not occur, or that if they occur, it is not possible to have adequate evidence for their occurrence. In order to get a result along these lines, one needs to supplement this argument with some additional premises, such as the following. Premise 5. Only scientific beliefs are justified beliefs. Only scientific beliefs are justified beliefs. 6. If only scientific beliefs are justified beliefs, and miracles are events such that their supernatural explanations lie beyond the scope of the natural sciences, then no one can have a justified belief that a miracle has occurred. The addition of these two premises generates the desired conclusion. 7. No one can have a justified belief that a miracle has occurred, from premises 1, 5, and 6. In this argument, premises 2 and 3 become superfluous, but the conclusion does follow from the remaining premises. However, this modification to Robinson's scientific practice argument employs a premise that is implausible in excelsior, namely premise 5. Premise 5, which says that only scientific beliefs are justified beliefs, can be seen to be false when one considers the following question. On what grounds do we think that some of our beliefs are scientific while other beliefs are not scientific? Presumably we make such a distinction. Demarcating or dividing what is and is not scientific is not itself a scientific endeavor. It is a philosophical endeavor. So at least some of our justified beliefs are not scientific. Namely, those beliefs concerning the limits of science. On this issue, Michael Stenmark says the following. Science cannot exclude the possibility that there are dimensions of reality which are neither describable in scientific language nor accessible to scientific explanations, simply because that issue is beyond the competence of science. We must also remember that the issue is not whether one can claim that science gives us an exhaustive account of reality, but whether that claim in particular is a scientific claim. But it cannot be a scientific claim since it cannot be evaluated by means of scientific investigation and experimentation. Rather, it must be an extra scientific claim, a philosophical claim, end quote. Since there is, since there is no experiment that can be conducted that will tell us what beliefs are properly scientific, determining the scope of science is a philosophical problem falling within the purview of the philosophy of science. In short, premise 5 is clearly and obviously false. That's okay. An advocate of Robinson's argument might attempt to salvage this argument by proposing that premise 5 is too strong and it needs to be made weaker and more plausible as follows. 5.1. Yes, I am that tedious. Scientific beliefs always have better or more justification the non-scientific beliefs, right? The idea is that if there's a scientific belief and a non-scientific belief, Even if the non-scientific belief has some sort of justification, the scientific belief will always have better justification or more justification. Altering premise 5 in this way requires that premise 6 also be modified. 6.1, if scientific beliefs always have better or more justification than non-scientific beliefs, and miracles are events such that their supernatural explanations lie beyond the scope of the natural sciences, then no one can claim, or then no one can have a justified belief that a miracle has occurred. When premises 5.1 and 6.1 are combined with premise 1, namely that miracles fall outside of the purview of the natural sciences, we obtain Robinson's desired conclusion. No one can have a justified belief that a miracle has occurred from the respective premises. Unfortunately, while premise 5.1 is slightly more credible than the highly implausible premise 5, premise 5.1 is not without its own difficulties. It is implausible to think that our scientific beliefs are more plausible than our mathematical beliefs, or that our scientific beliefs are more plausible than our first-person phenomenological beliefs. Say, for example, I feel hungry right now, or I'm sad. These beliefs possess a privileged status, or immediacy, or obviousness that does not accompany any scientific claim. Moreover, we have not even been given a reason to think that belief in the occurrence of a miracle cannot, at least in some instances, be as well justified or better justified than some of our scientific beliefs. Robinson has not provided any reason to think that evidence for the occurrence of a miracle could not be procured, specifically evidence that is at least as good or stronger than the evidence that one has for some particular scientific belief. So, without some supporting argument for premise 5.1, this second modification to Robinson's argument from scientific practice is at best an exercise in begging the question. But let us suppose, for the sake of argument, that this premise is true. Let us just grant it to Robinson. It turns out that the argument is still faulty. Even if it is true that one's belief in the occurrence of a miracle could never be as justified as, or more justified than, one's scientific beliefs, this would not entail the impossibility or unlikelihood of having a justified belief in the occurrence of a miracle, unless 6.1 is also true. However, there is no good reason to think that premise 6.1 is true. In fact, the only reason to think that premise 6.1 is true is if one already thinks that the scientific account of the world is or will be complete and exhaustive, so that nothing more could possibly be added to it, at least in its completed stage. Of course, if one assumes the very thing that needs to be proved, then one will obviously get the result that the belief in the occurrence of miracles could never be justified. So, in the first modification of Robinson's argument, the question-begging presumption of scientism is stated overtly in premise 5. Only scientific beliefs are justified. However, in this second modification of the argument, the question-begging presumption of scientism is shifted implicitly and then hidden in premise 6.1. Only if there is nothing beyond the scope of scientific inquiry, so that nothing could supersede the scientific account of the world, is it reasonable to think that premise 6.1 is true. Again, Robinson gives us no reason to think that any of this is true. In sum, the second attempt to extend Robinson's argument from scientific practice simply produces an argument that begs the question twice over in premise 5.1 and in premise 6.1. We now come to the capriciousness argument. Another argument can be disentangled from others found in Robinson's essay is the capriciousness argument. Robinson claims that if one invokes a miracle to explaining something, then scientific development would be made completely capricious because it would be a matter of whim whether one invoked the concept of a miracle or irregularity to explain an awkward result. As it turns out, this particular objection is occasionally repeated. For example, David Hull, in the science periodical Nature, asserts that if one allows reference to God or miraculous forces to explain the first origin of life or the evolution of the human species, or presumably any other event one has no way of limiting, this sort of explanation. Here, Hull seems to be saying that appeals to the miraculous are infectious, contagious, or conceptually malignant. Again, the analytic philosopher G.E. Moore seems to put forward a variant of this very argument. Moore endorses a strong conditional claim, which we can call Moore's conditional. There's a madness to the method. Moore's conditional: if a miracle is ever possible, it would follow that one can never legitimately claim that any particular thing is the cause of any other thing. Accordingly, since Moore thinks that some things can be legitimately claimed to be the cause of other things, for instance, when we make causal inferences based on scientific observations, he concludes that miracles are not possible. Why would Moore endorse this conditional, is the question I'm going to raise. Presumably, he endorses it because he thinks that no appeal to the miraculous can be a principled appeal, so that such an appeal is essentially capricious or unmanageable. However, and just as importantly, appealing to the miraculous is seen as infectious insofar as it tends to spread into other areas of thought. The following should suffice, I think, as a rigorous statement of this argument. Premise 8. Scientific investigation and development is and must be principled, reasoned, and judicious. Premise 9, an appeal to the miraculous is essentially and endemically arbitrary, erratic, and unprincipled. Premise 10, given that scientific investigation and development is and must be principled, reasoned, and judicious, and that an appeal to the miraculous is essentially and endemically arbitrary, erratic, and unprincipled, any appeal to the miraculous would obstruct scientific inquiry or overthrow our ordinary knowledge of specific causal connections. Therefore, from 8, 9, and 10, we get the conclusion. Any appeal to the miraculous would obstruct scientific inquiry or overthrow our ordinary knowledge of specific causal connections. Moreover, we add another premise, 12. If any appeal to the miraculous would obstruct scientific inquiry or overthrow our ordinary knowledge of specific causal connections, then any appeal to the miraculous is irrational and untenable. That is, belief in the possible occurrence of miracles is illegitimate or intellectually unacceptable. Therefore, from 11 and 12, we get the conclusion, there can be no appeals to the miraculous that are rational. That is, belief in the possible occurrence of miracles is illegitimate or intellectually unacceptable. According to this line of reasoning, any commitment to science or scientific reasoning, however slight, automatically discredits belief in the occurrence of miracles. It is almost as if the proponent of this sort of argument envisions someone who believes in the occurrence of a miracle as being noetically spastic, or as having the intellectual equivalent of Tourette's syndrome. Inasmuch as science is a rational enterprise that ought to be adopted, miracles ought to be considered irrational hangovers of a credulous and unscientific time, hangovers that impede scientific progress. In evaluating the capriciousness argument, our attention will be focused entirely on the truth or falsehood of its premises. In particular, premise 9 will command the lion's share of our attention. The fact that premise 9 is false can be shown on conceptual grounds as well as on empirical grounds. Recall that premise 9 says, an appeal to the miraculous is essentially and endemically arbitrary, erratic, or unprincipled. First, it is simply false on conceptual grounds that the appeal to the miraculous is essentially unprincipled or arbitrary or erratic. In fact, rational appeal to the miraculous is available to the proponent of miracles in that she can appeal to what is referred to as the surprise principle. According to this principle, an observation supports one hypothesis, call it H1, over another hypothesis, call it H2, if the observation is more surprising on hypothesis 2 than it is on hypothesis 1. So if one has two competing hypotheses, and on one hypothesis some observation would be expected, and on another hypothesis the same observation is unexpected, then the observation confirms the former hypothesis more than the latter hypothesis. For example, in trying to explain the occurrence of some event, if the hypothesis that some event is a miracle makes the occurrence of that event less surprising than the hypothesis that there is some unknown natural cause, then the event confirms the miracle hypothesis more than the hypothesis that the event was brought about by purely natural causes. While the surprise principle alone is sufficient to demonstrate that premise 9 is false, there are other criteria that the miracle enthusiast could employ as principled and rational guidelines for prescribing degrees of confidence to her various beliefs concerning miracles. For example, the fit of one's hypothesis with independently confirmed background beliefs, or considerations of the simplicity and elegance of one's hypothesis, are other principles that one can use to proportion one's beliefs in a way that is rational, consistent, regular, judicial, and sensible. Moreover, there is no reason to think that such principles dictate that one adopt indefeasible beliefs. What are those? That is, beliefs that cannot be revised or surrendered or rejected once adopted. Moreover, there are no a priori reasons to think that one will always be guided by such principles to adopt naturalistic hypotheses over hypotheses that involve the miraculous. So we can see that the appeal to a miracle is not necessarily unprincipled or erratic. even if it is in some particular cases, or in a great many cases, or even almost all cases. It can be guided by principles of confirmation, simplicity, fit with one's independently confirmed background beliefs, and with other intellectual virtues. Lydia McGrew provides an insightful discussion that unveils the faulty thinking with the capriciousness argument given above. She begins by stating the objection. Claims for the miraculous often elicit a horrified response from naturalistic scholars. If, say the historians, we allow the possibility that a miracle has occurred, it will be the death of historical inquiry. There will be then no principled reason to rule out the idea that a miracle worker makes stones or words in documents jump around to create misleading archaeological effects. McGrew continues, if we admit, say, God brought about some miracle, then we will have to admit on equal terms the possibility that God has been monkeying around with our lab equipment. After stating the capriciousness argument, McGrew suggests that the error in this line of thought can be brought out in the following analogy. And the analogy is longer, so I'll just say, begin quote. I have some friends who own a gun, which they used to keep in a gun case in their apartment. One day, the husband of the couple went to look at the gun and found it gone. He questioned his wife, who said that she hadn't touched the gun. They turned the apartment upside down, searching for it, to no avail. They racked their memories, but they were confident that they had not taken the gun out of the apartment on any occasion. Then the wife remembered the handyman. He had come to do some work and had been left alone in the apartment not long ago. Certainly, it was possible that he had taken the gun. On the other hand, they hesitated to suspect him. The handyman was a relative of their landlady who had always seemed an honest person. They had never heard of any complaint about the handyman from anyone else. Nor had they ever missed anything before when he had been in their apartment to do work. But the stubborn fact remained, the gun was gone. It was possible that one of them was lying to the other. It was possible that despite their thorough search, the gun was still somewhere in the apartment. But as the search went on over a period of days, the relative merits of the theft hypothesis grew. The husband delicately broached the subject to the handyman, who after some attempts at evasion, returned the gun. Lydia McGrew explains that even after this incident, her friends did not blame the handyman every time the car keys went missing, or blame him when the last piece of cake went missing, because it would not be rational to apply the handyman hypothesis to every missing object. McGrew concludes that those who believe in some historical miracles are in a similar position to my friends, and that the hypothesis of supernatural intervention in our normally stable world becomes reasonable when attempts to explain the evidence without such a hypothesis become ludicrous. While all of this looks fairly straightforward, it seemingly eludes Robinson, Moore, and their comrades. In addition to the conceptual demonstration of the falsity of premise 9, which I just gave, which mistakenly claims that the appeal to the miraculous is somehow endemically arbitrary and that one will appeal to miracles indiscriminately, one can also see that this premise is false on empirical grounds. The history of the development of contemporary science itself shows us that this claim is false. Concerning this issue, Dennis Alexander writes, and he says, the natural philosophers, that is, the scientists, of 17th century Europe were nearly all Christians who believed in a God who occasionally carried out miracles. Some may have believed that such miracles were confined to the biblical era, whereas others may have believed that God continued to carry out miracles very occasionally. But the general consensus of belief was in a miracle-working God. Far from a belief in a miracle-working God stimulating belief in a plethora of miracles, the early natural philosophers were generally quite opposed to such a move. Here, then, one finds direct empirical evidence in conflict with the assertion of premise 9, that the appeal to the miraculous will probably spread out over the remainder of one's beliefs like an intellectual plague. This assertion must be made in direct opposition to easily available empirical data concerning the history of the development of science. In summary, we can see that 9 can be faulted both on conceptual grounds and on empirical grounds. Given that 9 is obviously false, we have been given no good reason to think that miracles are incompatible with a general scientific outlook on things, or for thinking that belief in miracles is epistemically problematic, or problematic with respect to having knowledge generally. In short, the capriciousness argument is unsound. Now we come to a common objection. This is an objection that was raised when I presented an earlier version of this this paper to a philosophy of religion group that I once ran called the Dallas Socratic Society, and no quarter was ever given in that group. And this was the objection that was launched against this paper, and now I'm responding to it now. Looking at you. A common objection, the progress of science, sometimes called the God of the gaps fallacy or argument. One typical objection raised at this point is that the progress of modern science makes the appeal to miracles rationally untenable insofar as what we thought to be miracles are now rightly understood as processes that occur naturally in accordance with the laws of nature. In short, the number of things that previously were counted as miracles is now shrinking in number as the scientific explanations of these events grows in number. In other words, the gaps that were once filled in with appeals to supernatural causation are now being filled in with natural explanations. The gaps are shrinking, according to the God of the gaps objection, so that there is less and less room for appeals to anything other, other than natural causes. In fact, on this view, science has progressed so far that appealing to the miraculous is rationally unjustifiable. As is often the case, the details in this sort of objection are not unimportant. This objection was answered long ago by someone who states the reply clearly enough. If the miracles were offered us as events that normally occurred, then the progress of science, whose business it is to tell us what normally occurs, would render belief in them gradually harder and finally impossible. The progress of science has, in just this way, and greatly to our benefit, made all sorts of things incredible which our ancestors believed. man-eating ants and griffins and scythia, men with one single gigantic foot, magnetic islands that draw all ships towards them, mermaids and far-breathing dragons. But these things were never put forward as supernatural interruptions in the course of nature. They were put forward as items within her ordinary course. In fact, as science, if there were far-breathing dragons, our big game hunters would find them. But no one ever pretended that the virgin birth of Christ, the virgin birth, or Christ walking on the water, could be reckoned to recur or happen again. When a thing professes from the outset to be a unique invasion of nature by something from the outside of nature, increasing knowledge of nature can never make it either more or less credible than it was at the beginning. In this sense, it is a mere confusion of thought to suppose that advancing science has made it harder for us to accept miracles. We always knew they were contrary to the natural course of events. Now, this reply to the God of the Gap's objection, or more accurately, supernaturalism of the Gap's objection, does us the service of pointing out that many of the supposed gaps in our scientific understanding of things were never claimed to be filled with supernatural explanations in the first place. It's one thing to claim that science is replacing appeals to miracles as explanations. It's another thing altogether, and an entirely empirical question, to substantiate such a claim with facts from the historical record. Nevertheless, let us suppose, for the sake of argument, that the author here is wrong. Specifically, let us assume that many appeals to the miraculous have in fact been replaced with adequate scientific explanations of those events. I don't see this to be the case, but let's just say it's so. Let us just grant that. With granting this, renew the objection and thereby render belief in miracles inconsistent with contemporary science. No, it would not. The reason why can be illustrated with a simple analogy. With the advent of DNA testing, we have discovered that a great many rape convictions turned out to be false convictions, in which the innocent were wrongly accused of rape and then sent to prison. DNA testing has proven scientifically that these men were innocent of the crimes they were accused of and overturned those particular convictions. Moreover, continued DNA testing is continuing to show the innocence of such men. Suppose further that such testing were to show that the vast majority of rape accusations were false. Now, I don't think this to be true. I have no access to empirical data that would show this to be true. I'm just saying, let us say this for the sake of argument, that the vast majority of rape accusations have been demonstrated to be false by DNA testing. Would that render believing in any rape accusation irrational? Would rape accusations become inconsistent with the advent of contemporary science? Of course not. What does follow then? Well, supposing that most rape accusations, or even the vast majority of rape accusations and convictions, were demonstrated to be false by DNA testing, as many of them have turned out to be, the most that would follow is that one ought to be cautious about believing any particular rape accusation. Moreover, it certainly would not be irrational to think that some of these accusations are true, especially if one has the right kind of evidence in support of those accusations. In short, what follows from the alleged but as of yet undemonstrated progress of science in providing natural causes for alleged miracles is that one ought to be cautious in accepting any particular miracle claim. Not that accepting miracle claims is incompatible with the scientific outlook of on the world or irrational given the advances of science. And now we come to the conclusion, for which I'm sure you're quite grateful. In sum, we have seen that the contemporary aversion to the miraculous, inasmuch as it appeals to science, is entirely without foundation. The astoundingly implausible idea that miracles are either impossible or that they could only be believed by people that are intellectually substandard or hopelessly pre-scientific or anti-scientific is an assertion that has every appearance of being without evidential or argumentative support. The 20th century and beyond has simply produced no good argument or objection based on science capable of supporting such an unfounded conclusion. Not only are these arguments bad arguments, they are fantastically bad arguments. Drawing such strong conclusions from such weak and implausible premises is epistemically problematic at best, and certainly unconvincing. Miracles are neither logically scandalous, nor are they contrary to the principles of scientific investigation. And no one has ever shown otherwise. And I'll add, in conclusion, someone may show otherwise in the future, and I will be happy to look at that argument. Thank you very much.
Invited you to take off the gloves, so
who
wants the
first question? That's much more entertaining that way. Should I pick the...
I'll do that unless you...
I'm happy.
Okay. I have the microphone.
Oh, okay, you have it.
What would you say to the assertion that your arguments have about the same strength as the medieval arguments to prove that God existed?
Given that I think some of the medieval arguments for the existence of God are incredibly strong and that the objections against them seem to be fallacious, the typical objections against them tend to be fallacious, I would take that as a compliment.
Well, at least your existence.
To achieve that level of strength, I would think is quite an achievement on my part.
That's right. Neither of them are absolutely watertight arguments. So you have to look to other arguments, like plausibility arguments. These arguments of miraculous events always come from some individual recounting what they interpret as an event. So then you have to ask, what is more plausible? That the individual the event actually occurred, or that the individual misinterpreted the sensory information he got, or was just fantasizing.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's so right.
That makes it, puts it back in the realm of science, actually. Scientists evaluate events in terms of occurrences of evidence that is consistent with one theory or another theory, and if the evidence is consistent with a whole bunch of prior of theories which were believed beforehand, that theory will be abandoned and a new, more comprehensible theory.
Right. You've put forward two general points here, and I'd like to address your second one first, that this particular analysis puts it back into the realm of science. I disagree with that. I think it just puts it into the realm of common sense. In fact, there are plenty of miracle claims that I've looked at that I find to be extraordinarily implausible, not because I'm a scientist. I've never done a day's work of science in my life, so far as I know. But I can still, using principles of plausibility, make assessments of those particular miracle claims and find them wanting. My claim is that there's nothing in principle that would rule out, given the right kinds of evidence being brought forward, rendering some of those claims to be more plausible than their denials. Now, the claim, now let me go back to your first claim. The first general claim that you made was an articulation of David Hume's argument against miracles. And I had two chapters on David Hume's argument in my dissertation. And I'm just going to make a bold assertion, and maybe we can talk about it as we continue. My assertion is this, is that I think that David Hume's argument against the miraculous, or against principled belief, or rational belief in the occurrence of miracles, is the single most implausible argument in the history of philosophy to be widely accepted by analytic philosophers. Now, certainly there are more implausible arguments, but none so widely accepted.
Okay, then let me defend science by saying that, yes, it is common sense that you use to discount stories of flying spaghetti monsters and purple people eaters and teapots in orbit around Jupiter, but science is basically common sense applied in a rigorous and rational way.
I take it that science since the time of Francis Bacon, or what I like to call Baconian science, is the application of measurement to our empirical observation for the purpose of producing mathematical models or other types of models of unobserved entities capable of making predictions concerning our future observations. I think that goes quite a way beyond the mere exercise of prudence and common sense.
Patricia Churchland has written a number of books which you should read.
Let's listen to somebody else.
Yes, right? I have read some of Patricia Churchland's work.
I just have a simple question. If a miracle is repeatable, does it stop being a miracle? Does it become science then? Then it's observable, then predictable.
I don't think mere repeatability turns something into science. Right. If something has been repeated, that's one question. A more relevant question is, can it be repeated in exactly the same way given prior conditions? Right. And then we have something to start working with in terms of framing scientific hypotheses. And then a part, if you have an event that has been repeated or is repeatable, then you can begin to advance a scientific explanation of the event. It's not just the mere repetition, but it's repetition given prior events. I think that you might say, was it a miracle to begin with? That's your way of phrasing it that I find odd. Does it stop being a miracle? Well, if it was a miracle to begin with, it couldn't stop being a miracle. But I think what you want to say is that it was perceived to be a miracle, and it is no longer perceived to be a miracle, given that you've come up with a naturalistic explanation that doesn't in any way appeal for the supernatural.
Thank you.
Welcome.
When I first raised my hand, I had not located your definition of a miracle hidden in the footnotes.
Oh, yes.
I strongly recommend that you begin with a definition in future presentations.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, I agree that it's very difficult to pin down a miracle well enough to think that you can show they don't occur. I do think that there is a soft argument on the basis of productivity, if you will. To identify something as a miracle is, in fact, to suspend efforts to explain it. So you are doing something less than a complete identification if you continue to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
People do continue to work on all kinds of unsolved problems, and they often wind up with solutions which are, in fact, sometimes spurious. But I wonder if we can identify what things are miracles very well. The reliance on miracles, as opposed to believing in the existence of past miracles, seems to me quite unjustified, whereas the reliance on past successes based on the models of science is extremely justified. And
I want to say that
it takes a little bit more than this kind of argument on the existence of miracles to get beyond that. Now, on the existence of miracles, we cannot say that they did not occur, because science has progressively invented explanations that have turned out to be very productive in explaining natural phenomena for what were formerly miracles. Along about the 1900s, we saw all kinds of behaviors inside atoms that seemed to be completely inexplicable and were therefore miracles. But scientists are busy little beavers, and they built a big framework that explained not only those things, but many other things. And with the advent of quantum theory, we can hardly explain anything except to say that on the statistical whole, we believe what we're seeing.
Right. I want to say that you made a number of claims there, and now I'm having trouble keeping them straight.
All right.
I hold that a miracle is either a suspension or superseding of the regular workings of the world, and one could add, but I don't think it's necessary to add, brought about by a supernatural agency of some sort. You said that it's very difficult to pin down any particular miracle candidates, given that they're difficult to pin down. I would, in fact, agree with that. I think that they're coming up with plausible miracle candidates is a difficult enterprise. And to that end, I just want to mention that there was a philosopher, Dedel, who came up with an example, just conceptually, right? He said, suppose that there were a horse who you monitored multiple ways around the clock, and who you didn't feed or give water or any nourishment to at all in any way for a number of years. And instead of dying, starving to death, the horse began to thrive and then began to win races. But still, no means of nourishment was being provided to the horses in the way we ordinarily understand horses to be nourished. I think that under those conditions, we would have a very strong candidate in terms of for a miracle. And the miracle hypothesis would be a live option on the table at that point. And the reason why is because in order to somehow bring that particular example into the fold of natural events, we would have to get rid of almost everything we know about biology and chemistry and physics. And I don't think that that is a very profitable route to go down. However, one might in the future discover the hidden means by which that horse is being nourished. And your last claim was that miracles impede the speculative or the investigatory progress that scientists engage in. Now, yes, and I would agree that some people are psychologically disposed such that once they appeal to a miracle, that's it for them. They're done. They don't care about scientific hypotheses anymore. But that's a psychological fact about those individuals. That is not a principle of scientific investigation. And there are other people who, when they have a miracle candidate before them, they press the empirical and scientific investigation yet further and harder. And I would say, good on them, right? So in that respect, insofar as individuals may put forward candidates of miraculous events for consideration, it could in fact spur scientific discovery rather than impede it. So the objection that you brought to my attention is just one of contingency, not one of principle. And I'm unfazed by objections of contingency. I want an objection in principle.
Is that a principle?
Yes, that's my principle. All right, hey, here it comes.
It's obvious that these scientists are naturalists.
Not necessarily all of them.
The idea came up of the concept of accounting for miracles themselves. If you have the presuppositions of a naturalist, how then can you account for the concept of a God-breathed miracle? If you cannot itself even account for the concept of God, since God is not a composite found in natural observation or by empirical methods, somehow the concept of God, though, got through the door, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So we have to then account for a concept that we can't observationally account for. If you're a naturalist, then you're jumping outside of the presuppositions of a naturalist to then talk about how the concept of miracles is absurd. So on the presuppositions of naturalism, how is the concept of God or God miracles absurd? Or is it just philosophically arbitrary? You know what I'm saying? So,
right.
To me, it's like we associate miracles to God. Mm-hmm. Okay, basically.
So some do. Yeah.
Well, I do. I mean, I kind of.
One doesn't have to.
I hold that, or God. These are associated to God. These are not things that a naturalist can account for, given his presuppositions about reality, the nature of knowledge, ontologically speaking, empirically speaking, the naturalist cannot find these concepts. So therefore, he must jump out of his presuppositions as a naturalist to then find some sort of complaint about the concept of miracle itself. In other words, I think that they are mutually exclusive on purpose. Like, God used miracles to have the impact because that's what he wanted to, that's what he knew it would take to get the point across, so to speak.
I see.
So they are mutually exclusive by definition. There's no way that they can coexist. I said earlier, here before you got started, I said there's either two spots for a miracle. Either it's a baby theory, it's not completely worked out yet, and it's temporal, and it's eventually going to be worked out scientifically, or by definition, they can never be worked out scientifically.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, just to recap to make sure I'm following you or I'm tracking with you, you're saying that given that naturalism conceptually excludes the miraculous and the divine, And given that the miraculous or the divine is conceptually incompatible with the truth of naturalism, you can't hold both simultaneously.
There's not this neutrality.
Right. Now, I will say this, that if naturalism is true, then miracles are, as a matter of principle, off the table. Then the question becomes, is what reason do we have to think that naturalism is true? What is the evidence for it? What can be said in its favor? What are its merits and what are its demerits? And as I tend to think that there is, in particular, one conclusive argument against naturalism. It doesn't have anything at all to do with miracles, but it's the argument from reason, first presented by Plato in the Phaedo, and then later rearticulated by Arthur Balfour, and then again rearticulated by C.S. Lewis, and then later by William Hasker, and again by Victor Reppert in his book C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. And I think that this argument is about as close as one can get to a conclusive argument in philosophy. Now that's a different paper, and I can't go over the details of that particular argument against naturalism here. Or I can maybe in conversation afterwards, but...
I still think that it stops at God. So if a naturalist, if it's a natural world, then how did God get in? And then if you have miracles...
Right, you're pointing that. To the incompatibility, so right.
Well, then how do we get God if naturalism is true?
You can't. If naturalism is...
How are you getting to the concept of God if it is non...
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So there's nothing
okay.
that we can...
I misunderstood your point. So now I take it that what you're saying is, and I'll get to you, what you're saying is that if naturalism is true, why would anyone ever have a concept of God in the first place?
And miracles.
Or miracles, right.
Right.
I see. So you're advancing an argument against naturalism there.
Yes.
Well, I'd have to think about that.
It's inconsistent.
I'm going to make mine short.
Thank you.
I'm a scientist, and I disagree with a lot of what you said, but I'm not going to argue with you because I...
Please do.
You're not going to be affected by facts.
Yeah. Okay. Before you start your questions, let me just say preface this.
Let me
preface this by saying I have changed my positions, my worldview, dozens of times on the basis of argument. And that's a presumption that you're making about me on the basis of no evidence whatsoever. And that is very... No. That is very unscientific of you.
It is unscientific. Now, the two questions are, why do you believe in miracles, or why do you want to believe in miracles? The second question is, can you name a miracle that you believe in that you have experienced yourself? Not read about or been told about, but seen yourself.
Okay. My answer to the first question is I don't want to believe in miracles, and the second answer to the second question is no.
Okay, good.
Good
job.
All right. This is good. So, to paraphrase, to start with the great philosopher Shakespeare, more or less, there are more things in heaven and earth that are gripped up in your philosophy. I'll spot you that. With that being said, I think one of the earlier questions touched on it, but didn't quite get it. The essence of the scientific method is not only repeatable, it's repeatable and testable. You referenced at one point in your conversation with God of gaps and how, you know, as human knowledge has progressed, as you perhaps incorporating a little Buddhist thinking here, on our own collective journey towards enlightenment, we're finding more and more ways to explain the world around us. That being said, perhaps there is always room beyond the scientific method to answer those questions that haven't yet been answered. But within the scientific method, using your own words, a miracle is a unique inversion of nature. It is not a repeatable and testable fashion. And moreover, who would presume to test the supernatural agent responsible for the said miracle?
Yeah, I think you make a very good point there. And you're right. Miracles, if they occur, cannot be deterministically repeated or stochastically repeated via the sorts of ordinary means of investigation that we use in the scientific enterprise. I grant all of that. What follows from that is that miracles or miraculous explanations, insofar as one is proffering a miraculous explanation, are not scientific. I think that's correct. Now, what follows from this? Does it follow that one can't have any principled reason to believe in the occurrence of a miracle? No, it doesn't. Not unless you sneak in the premise that the only good explanations are scientific explanations. And without that premise, you're not going to be able to make much hay against miracles in principle.
Yeah, what's your...
Oh, I'm sorry.
What is your principled reason for believing in miracles?
I don't say that I believe in miracles.
But you say there is a principled belief. What is the principled belief?
I never said that there was a principled belief to believe in any particular miracle. What I said was that there's no in that there are no in successful in principle reasons against the miraculous, and that it is at least possible that one could have in principled reasons for the miraculous.
I think Carl Sagan said something about that.
Yes, the extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so does it follow from that that miracles can never be rationally believed? Well, of course not. The most that follows from that is that one must exercise his caution and skepticism, and one must investigate the issue thoroughly. I think...
Very scientific thing to do.
In fact, one could do that without being a scientist. And one can do that just by being very cautious and judicious and prudential. And furthermore, this claim of Sagan's, it's interesting to note, I did a paper on this particular claim. It's about 15 pages. And what I did was I traced the history of that claim. That claim originally occurred within the context of Christian Christology, the theology of Christian Christology, and the idea there that theologians of the late 1700s and the early 1800s would often echo that very claim, and in some cases use almost exactly the same words in discussing the theology of the deity of Jesus. And they said if Jesus was in fact deity, then there would be need to be extraordinary evidence backing up that claim. And then at that point, they began to appeal to the miraculous, namely Jesus' resurrection from the dead, which is itself an extraordinary claim, right? And would be extraordinary evidence. So then we might end up with an infinite regress, and in which no evidence could ever be good enough to certify any claim at all when it's extraordinary. But then that would be begging the question. So at some point, you're just going to have some ordinary evidence at some point in that chain.
Yeah, Dr. Lee, thanks for coming. I've never seen this audience quite as engaged for so long.
Yeah, I've tended people to get fired people up.
Yeah, I want to ask you a question that I'm just trying to learn more about what you're saying.
Sure.
If you took your premises and you extrapolated them backwards in time, 100 years, 400 years, and let's say it's pre-Big Bang, let's say it's pre-Galileo even trying to determine do all objects at different masses fall at different rates or are they the same rate? Or if we're talking about the Big Bang and Robert Hoyle, who denied, or I think almost to his death, the evidence of an expanding universe and even more recently an accelerating universe.
That's right.
You take your premises and you say, how would they test the word miracle, by their definition, maybe not the one you proposed, against history, and that is the evolution of science? Because you use the word science a lot in your paper.
Yeah. I'll try to use the word science less. So let me see if I understand. You want me to go back 100 years prior to the advent of Big Bang cosmology? Right. Then how would scientists in that time think about miracles? Perhaps in respect to the Big Bang cosmology?
Yeah, or other, all clocks.
I don't think that the Big Bang cosmology could be cited as a miracle candidate. And the reason why I don't think that that's the case is that a miracle candidate has to be an event which runs against or supersedes the ordinary workings of the world. But prior to the advent of the universe, there are no ordinary workings of the world to supersede or...
precedes ordinary workings.
Right. No, I think the supersede or suspend is right, because that way I can work with both necessary and sufficient conditions. Right, but that's chapter one of my dissertation. Okay.
Well, we've got time for one more, and
sure.
I'd like to go to somebody that hasn't asked a question yet, if somebody has one. Otherwise...
we got one over here.
Here we go, back over here.
All right, let's bring the hay.
Well, if you had a horse that had no substance or ears, then that would be...
Can you turn it on?
Repeatability over time.
Just hold it close to your mouth.
Hold it, okay. Yeah.
But...
I'm sorry, can you repeat the first part of that?
If you had a horse that had no obvious means of substance over ears, and yet things die, etc., then that would essentially be repeatable, right? But every day it seemed to be repeating. The horse would have died every month.
Right, and this is how we come up with scientific laws concerning nutrition.
So that would be repeatable. But we don't... tell me if I'm wrong. Do you have any examples a miracle is an exception to the rules, the known understanding rules of physics, but I haven't actually seen anything that's attributed as a miracle that is actually well documented that it violated the rules. And so it seems to me that the term labeling something as a miracle is, it's indistinguishable from and maybe even equivalent to just saying, I don't know, it's just sheer ignorance.
Right.
Can you differentiate miracle from ignorance?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. In the case that the philosopher Dedel, the case of the non-fed, non-watered horse, right? Just to continue with that example. For example, let's say if I just see this glass fall over, right? And, well, you know, I don't know what would cause it to fall over, but, you know, what laws are on the table that would be violated or superseded there? It's not clear to me. Maybe if we had more controlled conditions, we could, right? And in the case of the horse, right, we have really well-established laws of biology and nutrition and chemistry. That particular case, and of course Dedel wasn't, that was just a case he made up. That wasn't something he took out of the newspaper or something. He was just saying, if that occurred, he said, I would grant that to be a miracle candidate. Maybe there's a natural explanation for it, maybe not. But at least it's not beyond the realm of rationality to say that maybe there's a supernatural cause at work here. What is that supernatural cause? I don't know. Unless more context is provided.
That's all I wanted to hear. Is
that's exactly, yeah.
It's equivalent to
that's
I don't know.
Exactly, right. That's exactly
and,
right.
And again, you have the
example. I don't know other than the natural, right, explanation, or the natural account of this event doesn't seem to be capturing the event. So it would count as evidence against the truth of naturalism.
Only because you couldn't document the conditions.
No, with a horse we can document the conditions.
Oh, if that occurred, sure.
Right.
But if your water spontaneously fell off the table and you didn't really have any observations of the conditions that
that's right.
Under,
that's right.
So you really have no examples of well-documented...
Well, I said earlier that I haven't presented any cases.
And you seem to freely admit that you cannot distinguish it from ignorance.
No, I said unless some sort of context were provided. If there is... Now we're pressing against our time limit, I think, here, but maybe we can talk more about it afterwards. If there is a context provided, right, let's say some miracle worker rolls into town. And I have a very, very dim view of faith healers. It makes me angry to think about them and talk about them. But let's say that there is a faith healer that rolls into town, and he says, I'm going to do these things by the power of God, and he goes down to the hospital, and he causes people to grow limbs and come back from the dead, right, and grow eyes where they were blind. I think that we would have a context in that case of saying the source of that miracle isn't just something unknown, but perhaps divine.
It wouldn't be an exclusive argument,
but it would be evidence in the favor of that hypothesis.
Okay, let's thank Dr. Lee again.
I'm like, 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 I'm